Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Oh my God, my feet, my body is dead. Today's episode is brought to you by McDonald's. Not an official sponsor, but might as well be. And the beverage, Coke Zero from McDonald's. Oh God, I got my food here in front of me. I can smell it, but I'm not going to eat it until we do this chapter. Needless to say, I'll probably do it pretty quickly. I've just come from a 13 and a half hour shift at the winery. We did lunches, added kitchen handing and waiting tables and washing dishes. And then we set up for a wedding, then we had the wedding, then we packed up for the wedding. I was there from 10 a.m. till 11:30. And no break. 13 and a half hours, no break. My feet are killing me. So I feel like I've well earned this McDonald's. But then I got home and I'm like, I'm so tired and so hungry. I'm just going to stuff my face and then just pretty much fall asleep in the rubbish. In a pile of my own filth. So I'm going to do the podcast first really quickly. And I have the food here to tempt me to do it quicker. So, excuse me if I rush a little bit through this episode. Part 8, Chapter 16. Can anyone Eli 5 the Slavic question and why Tolstoy's stance on it is bad? Swim said the mumfishy, said, Tolstoy's stance isn't bad, it was just unpopular. In the summer of 1875, Orthodox Christians in the Herzegovina revolted against their Ottoman overlords. In 1876, the Slav principalities of Serbia and Montenegro declared war on Turkey, and there was an uprising in Bulgaria. In Russia, there were fervent support for the Serbian cause. Russians voluntarily sent money and medical supplies to the Orthodox Slavs, and many Russian volunteers went to the Balkans to fight. Russian newspapers took on the Serb cause. Beverage sip break. Delicious. Tolstoy, through Levin and their prince, and the prince, takes an unpopular position. Fyodor Dostoevsky was passionately in favour of military intervention for humanitarian and patriotic reasons. Leo Tolstoy, although not yet a fully-fledged pacifist, could not see the point in Russia getting involved. Dostoy was in tune with the popular mood. Levin, in Part 8, is actually not so much hostile to the Slavophiles as baffled by them. In conversation with the likes of Koznishev, Levin is not even confrontational enough to keep up the argument for very long. His attitude, basically Tolstoy's own, is of bewilderment that so many people are passionately committed to actions in a place they know little about. Levin suggests that when people become passionately committed to a faraway cause, instead of devoting themselves to problems near at hand, the reason is probably to be found in their own psychological makeup. Very good explanation. Thank you very much for that, Swimmy Seti the Mama Fishy. I am Norwegian said, I think this is a great point. It's how I think a lot of people treat politics nowadays, as a sort of shield against having to think about their own lives. Instead of sorting themselves out, they attempt to fix the entire world simply by holding the right opinions and getting angry at the people they imagine to hold the wrong opinions. Eek. Simply Productive said, I kind of agree, but also eek. Simply Productive said, I'm just a bit surprised that the media then was as suppressive of alternative views. Sorry, go again. I am just a bit surprised that the media then was as suppressive of alternate views points as it is today. I had a phase where I would read no fewer than 8 different newspaper articles on one topic before I could make an opinion. It was a great exercise, but man, why? Just too much work. Yeah, I mean, why is the burden on us to try to sift through all these opinions laced through seemingly, apparently, balanced articles? They never are balanced, are they? Sip break. And you know what? Chip break. Yeah, that's right. I'm eating a chip. Oh, they're so good. Oh, they're so good. How do they do it? How do they do that? Amazing. Chapter 17 goes like this. Sorry if I've made everyone hungry. Or put you off your dinner. Ah, stop eating. The prince and Koznishev got into the trap and drove off. The rest of the party, hastening their steps, went home on foot. But the cloud, now whiter, now blacker, approached so rapidly that it was necessary to hurry still more to reach home before the rain came. The forepart of the cloud, low and black like sooty smoke, rushed with unusual swiftness across the sky. When they were still about 200 paces from the house, the wind had already risen, so that at any moment the downpour might be expected. The children, with frightened and joyful yells, ran on in the front. Dolly, struggling with difficulty with the skirts that clung to her legs, no longer walked but ran, her eyes fixed on the children. The men holding their hats went on with long strides. They were just reaching the porch when a large drop broke against the edge of the iron gutter. The children, followed by the grown-ups, ran, talking merrily, under the shelter of the roof. And Catherine Alexandrovna, speaking to the servant Levin, gives Kitty her full name. Levin asked Agatha Mikhailovna, who, carrying shawls and plaids, met them in the hall. "We thought she was with you," she answered. "And Mitya?" "In Kolok, I expect, and a nurse is with them." Levin snatched up the plaids and rushed to the Kolok. In that short time, the centre of the dark cloud had already so moved over the sun that it was as dark as during an eclipse. The wind, obstinately, as if insisting on having its way, pushed Levin back and tearing the leaves and blossoms off the lime trees and rudely and strangely uncovering the white branches of birches, bent everything in one direction, the acacias, the flowers, the dock leaves, the grass, and the crests of the trees. The girls who had been working in the garden rushed screeching under the roof of the servants' quarters. A white curtain of pouring rain was already descending over the distant wood and half the neighbouring field and was advancing rapidly toward the Kolok. The moisture of the rain, shattered into minute drops, filled the air. Lowering his head and fighting against the wind, which was tearing the plaids out of his hands, Levin had almost reached the Kolok and could see something gleaming white behind an oak, when suddenly everything burst into flame, the earth seemed on fire, and just overhead the vault of heaven seemed to crack. When he opened his dazzled eyes, the first thing Levin saw was horror through the dense curtain of rain that now separated him from the Kolok. Was the strangely altered position of the green crown of a familiar oak in the middle of the wood. Has it been struck? He had barely time to think when, with quicker and quicker motion, the crown of the oak disappeared behind the other trees, and he heard the crash of a big tree falling onto the other trees. The flash of lightning, the sound of thunder, and the sudden cold sensation of his body that was being drenched merged for Levin into one feeling of horror. Oh God, only not on them, he said. And though it occurred to him at once how senseless was his prayer that they should not be killed by the oak that had already fallen, he repeated it, knowing that he could do nothing better than utter that senseless prayer. Having run to the spot where they generally went, he did not find them there. They were at the other end of the wood, under an old lime tree, and were calling him. Two figures in dark dresses, they had been light-coloured before, stood bending over something. They were Kitty and the nurse. The rain was already passing, and it was growing lighter when Levin reached them. The bottom of the nurse's dress was dry, but Kitty's dress was wet through and clung close to her. Though the rain had stopped, they were still standing on the same postures that they had adopted when the storm began. They stood leaning over a perambulator with a green hood. "Alive? Safe? Thank God," he muttered, running up to them and splashing through the puddles with one shoe half off and full of water. Kitty's wet and rosy face was turned to him, timidly smiling beneath her bedraggled hat. Aren't you ashamed of yourself? I don't understand how one can be so imprudent," he reproached his wife in his vexation. "Really, it was not my fault. I was just wishing to go when he became restless. We had to change his things. We had hardly..." Kitty began excusing herself. Mitya was safe and dry and slept undisturbed. "Well, thank God, I don't know what I am saying." They collected the wet baby things, and the nurse took the baby in her arms and carried him. Levin walked beside his wife, feeling guilty at having been vexed, and stealthily, so that the nurse could not see, pressing Kitty's hand. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. Boom, lightning strike. Have your say over at the Hemingway List. Thanks for listening. I'm going to go eat some McDonald's. Woohoo! See you tomorrow.